welcome to another episode of NLDR, the Narrative Lectionary Podcast for people on the go. My name is Dr. Amy Robertson, and I'm here with my friend and colleague, Dr. Robert Williamson. Each week, we talk about how this week's part of the Narrative Lectionary resonates for us as Bible scholars and as people who are deeply enmeshed in our Jewish and Christian faith communities. This week, we move from the Hebrew Bible into the New Testament and spend time with Luke chapter 1. We explore its orientation towards the future and its theme of preparedness. We wonder at the notion of spiritual preparation that takes place in the wilderness. And we imagine the angel Gabriel telling Zechariah to talk to the hand. Thanks for being with us. Hey, Bobby, it's good to see you.
Hey, Amy, it's good to see you too.
We have moved into a different testament.
We have.
New Testament.
Yes, it is. It is the new one. The second testament, or the appendix, as some people call it.
I wasn't going to say that, but yes, some people do call it that. There's a Jewish blessing for starting something new called the Shehechianu. So I have in my head this sort of like Shehechianu, like this is a, we have arrived at a new moment for our podcast and our biblical conversation, and I'm excited to see where it goes.
Yeah.
So we are in a New Testament, and so certainly there is some context that would be helpful here, just sort of historically, where are we?
The text, you know, says this is taking place in the days of King Herod of Judea. That seems to be a reference to King Herod the Great, who was the king from roughly 37 BCE to 4 BCE. So we're somewhere right around, obviously, around the turn of the millennium, probably roughly 6 BCE is where we are. The Gospel of Luke is probably written toward the end of the first century or the beginning of the second century, so about 100 years removed from the events that it describes. This is a period in the history of Judea in which they're under Roman occupation. They have been under Roman occupation since about 64 BCE. Herod is the king of Judea, but he is a vassal of the Roman emperor, who in this period is Augustus. Octavian is the emperor.
Okay, so with that, let's jump in and see what else we can tell about sort of at least our narrative setting, if not our historical setting.
Let's do it.
So starting in verse 5, in the days of King Herod of Judea, there was a priest named Zechariah who belonged to the priestly order of Abijah. His wife was a descendant of Aaron, and her name was Elizabeth. Both of them were righteous before God, living blamelessly according to all the commandments and regulations of the Lord. But they had no children because Elizabeth was barren and both were getting on in years. So what I see here is we're talking about a priesthood, right? Mm-hmm. And so one thing just sort of for context, we'll read a little bit more about this. But when we left off in Ezra, they were sort of reestablishing the cult, right? They were building the second temple, and they had those different generations of people who had come back from the exile who were witnessing this reestablishment of the temple. The temple seems to be up and running.
Yes.
Right? It has a priesthood, and it's very clear in this text that the priesthood is connected in all the ways you would want it to be to the historical priesthood, to Abijah and to Aaron, and it's all good there.
So one of the important things here, as you notice that both Zechariah and Elizabeth are from priestly families. They're both descended from Aaron, and so this is the way priestly daughters were meant to marry priests, and so we're all in the family, basically, here. There are 24 divisions of Levites that are given in 1 Chronicles 24, and Abijah is one of those. And so he's from one of the 24 kind of divisions of the Levitical priestly tribes.
And then it picks up this sort of common biblical theme of Elizabeth being barren, right? These are two incredibly righteous people, and they're unable to bear children.
Right, yeah. So you're thinking back about, you know, Sarah fits into this category quite closely because she also was old.
Yeah.
But then we can also think of Rachel and Leah, and in this text maybe Hannah.
I think Hannah especially for me, coming up. All right, we are now in verse 8. Once when he was serving as priest before God and his section was on duty, he was chosen by lot, according to the custom of the priesthood, to enter the sanctuary of the Lord and offer incense. Now, at the time of the incense offering, the whole assembly of the people was praying outside. Then there appeared to him an angel of the Lord standing at the right side of the altar of incense. When Zechariah saw him, he was terrified, and fear overwhelmed him. But the angel said to him, "Do not be afraid, Zechariah, for your prayer has been heard. Your wife Elizabeth will bear you a son, and you will name him John." So that takes us through verse 13, which is the first chunk that is officially in the narrative lectionary. So what are some things you see?
So we talked a little bit ago about the 24 sections of the divisions of Levitical priests.
Right, yeah.
So there are 24 of these divisions, and so they each spend 1 week at the temple, mm-hmm. twice a year. Mm-hmm. So, you know, 50 weeks a year, they're at home, wherever they're from, like all around Judea. And then for 2 1-week sessions, they are responsible for doing the priestly things in the temple. Then there's also the chief priests, I suppose, who are always there.
Right, who are like more full-time. Mm-hmm.
And so Zechariah is one of these. So he lives away, and then twice a year he comes in to spend 1 week in the temple. So his section is on duty, so that means it's his division is at the temple. And then he was chosen by lot according to the custom of the priesthood to enter the sanctuary of the Lord and offer incense. The division of priests is large. Like, there's a whole lot of people in a division. Mm-hmm. And so each person only one time in their life would be selected to go in and offer the incense. And so they would take a list of people who had never done it, and they would cast lots. Basically, they're rolling dice. And the belief in the ancient world was when you roll dice, that's not random. That is that's the way the divine beings make their will known.
Make their will known, right.
Burn the dice up, right. So Zechariah, he's old, and he's never done this before. And so then he is chosen by divine lot to go in and offer the incense.
That really like ups the ante. Yeah, that puts a lot of, I mean, it's already like a secret moment. It's sort of given that it's a secret moment, and he has this encounter with an angel. And so like, it just sort of, but it sort of is upping it more and more.
Yeah.
The more sort of layers you peel back from it.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. So an angel appears to Zechariah. Any thoughts about that kind of like interaction? I mean, we just get a little bit of it so far.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking about, so this is where I started to come to the question, like, where do we see continuity with the sort of traditions we've seen in the Bible? And where do we see some discontinuity?
Yeah.
Usually when you encounter an angel in the Hebrew Bible, it is not clear immediately that it's not a person. Like, there's this, you encounter a man, or is it an angel, or is it a messenger, you know? And here, it's like immediately, Zechariah saw an angel. And then as we go on to read some more, I mean, we're gonna learn the angel's name.
Yeah.
Like, the angel just straight up tells him a message from God. It's almost, it's different. It's different than what I know in the Hebrew Bible.
Yeah, you're making me think back to our conversation about Abram and Sarai and, or maybe it's Abraham and Sarah by then, in Genesis 18 that we talked about way back at the beginning of the podcast. And there's, God shows up with two angels, but it's never entirely clear in the text that that's who they are.
Right.
It was very different than this. You're right. And in that text, the angel announces to Abraham that Sarah's going to have a child. And here you have the angel announcing to Zechariah that Elizabeth's going to have a child. So, like, in my mind, these two stories of Abraham, Sarah, Zechariah, and Elizabeth, they're meant to be read together in all these ways. But you're right. This is a little more, like, there's no ambiguity about who this is. And the fact that the angel has to say, "Don't be afraid," means Zechariah was afraid, which means he knew who the angel was.
All right. Should we go on?
Oh, it's probably worth saying just in verse 10, the whole assembly of the people was praying outside. Mm. And so the people have gathered in the temple for this ritual, and Zechariah has gone in, and they're waiting for him to come back out. And this is a prayerful moment, and he's going to come back out and pronounce the priestly blessing. So this whole thing that's happening with the angel is like, there is an expectation amongst the people who are still outside. This is not a private, I mean, Zechariah is in private.
Zechariah is alone, yes.
He's the only one in there with the angel. But
people are waiting for him.
He has gone in from a crowd, and he is expected to go out to a crowd. And so
he goes in sort of on behalf of a crowd.
Right,
like
exactly.
He's like a representative, and so they're waiting for him.
Exactly, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
So starting with verse 14. "You will have joy and gladness, and many will rejoice at his birth, for he will be great in the sight of the Lord. He must never drink wine or strong drink. Even before his birth, he will be filled with the Holy Spirit. He will turn many of the people of Israel to the Lord their God. With the spirit and power of Elijah, he will go before him to turn the hearts of parents to their children and the disobedient to the wisdom of the righteous, to make ready a people prepared for the Lord. There's a lot of cool stuff in here. Okay, first of all, he can't have wine or strong drink, which again makes you think of the Nazarite.
Yeah. Were we playing a game there?
We are. Yeah, it was a game.
What is a Nazarite?
What is a Nazarite?
What is a Nazarite?
Which again, someone who can't have wine or strong drink, which again makes me think of Hannah.
Yeah, why?
Right? Because, well, when Hannah is, you know, Hannah can't have children, prays for a child, has a child, and makes a promise that she will devote this child to the service of the Lord.
I think it's really interesting. And I think that what you're seeing is exactly right, that the gospel writer Luke is intentionally styling his telling of the birth of John the Baptist on the story of Hannah and Samuel. To what end, I'm not entirely sure, but what you're seeing, I think, is really important.
Oh, but it's verse 17 that's so great. We have to talk about verse 17.
Yeah, what do you want to say?
There are a lot of parts about verse 17 that I want to talk about.
So, to me, the part that stands out first in verse 17 is the spirit and power of Elijah. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just curious what you're, when you read that, like there's a clear Hebrew Bible reference when you're...
I was going to ask you that question.
Yeah.
So when I think of Elijah, typically when I see a reference to Elijah, I'm thinking of the fact that the Hebrew Bible doesn't record his death.
Yeah.
And so, you know, he rises in a chariot or whatever up to the heavens. And so there's this thinking there's a thinking that he's still around somewhere. And
yeah,
his spirit is around. And, you know, at the Passover Seder, we expect Elijah to come back. And there is an idea. Oh, now I'm thinking about the Passover Seder and thinking there's the idea that Elijah right. will herald the coming of the Messiah.
Yeah.
Now I got you. I was a little slow there, but I got there eventually.
Yeah.
Got there through the back door.
Yeah. Luke is actually, there's a general reference here to Elijah, but he is very specifically referencing the prophet Malachi chapter 4, verse 6, which says, he will turn the, verse 5 and 6, "Lo, I will send you the prophet Elijah before the great and terrible day of the Lord comes. He will turn the hearts of parents to their children and the hearts of children to their parents, so that I will not come and strike the land with a curse." And so you hear that, you know, here it's with the spirit and power of Elijah, he will go before him to turn the hearts of parents to their children and the disobedient to the wisdom of the righteous, to make a people's way prepare for the Lord. So you can hear the clear echo there of Malachi. In the Jewish tradition, the Hebrew Bible ends with the Book of Chronicles. Mm-hmm. But in the Christian tradition, the Old Testament...
It's a different order, yeah.
It ends with Malachi. So that prediction of Elijah is the very last thing in the Christian Old Testament. And then you flip the page, and now we're in Matthew, right? We're telling the Gospels. And so for the Christian tradition, that connection, like, hey, Elijah's going to come as a herald of the Messiah. Hey, here's Elijah. Like, and so, you know what I mean? Like,
right.
This is establishing that connection clearly between those two corpuses. Mm-hmm.
Yes, there's a very clear tie. And then then it says, with the spirit and power of Elijah, he will go before him. So I assume that's John is the first he, right?
Yeah.
John will go before him.
Yeah.
Before whom?
So, Jesus.
Right, but Jesus hasn't come up yet, so it's...
Oh, I see what you're saying.
You know, it just, he will come before him,
Sorry, I was like, surely you know, the correct answer.
No, I assume,
the correct,
I
the correct the answer to anything in the New Testament is Jesus.
Jesus! right, no, I mean, I assume that, but it's, you know, they say in a sentence, you shouldn't refer, if you haven't already used the noun, you should be careful about using too many pronouns, but this whole gospel hasn't had Jesus in it yet.
So you're correct. You're basically correcting Gabriel's grammar.
Correcting Gabriel's
vague
grammar.
Vague antecedents.
Gabriel's going to make me mute too. Stop it.
You need to say Jesus before you use the pronoun. I love it.
Okay. So then I love that quote from Malachi that has turned the hearts of the parents to the children and the children to the parents. Mm-hmm. And I think it's so interesting that here it gives the parents to the children, turns the hearts of the parents to the children.
Oh, yeah.
This, the last part of this verse to me seems so future-oriented. You know, parents to the children, and then the last part of the verse where it talks about make ready a people prepared for the Lord, which again, that doesn't feel like familiar language or a familiar trope to me from most of the biblical texts.
Wait, to sort of make ready a people prepared for the Lord.
There's so much preparation. There's like parents to the children, and then we're making ready, like we're preparing a people to be prepared. Like it's something big is coming.
Yeah, oh yeah, absolutely.
What could it be?
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, to me, it's echoing the passage we did a couple weeks ago, Isaiah 40, which is
yes, absolutely. The Lord. Yes, yeah. It is echoing. Yes. It is absolutely echoing Isaiah.
And so this the preparation that John is going to do, and you know, actually John does get connected to that figure. Voice cries out in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord. So yeah, that's John's role is to make
to
preparation.
Prepare. Verse 18, Zechariah said to the angel, how will I know that this is so? For I am an old man and my wife is getting on in years. The angel replied, I am Gabriel. I stand in the presence of God, and I have been sent to speak to you and to bring you this good news. But now, because you did not believe my words, which will be fulfilled in their time, you will become mute, unable to speak until the day these things occur.
Do you read? So I read Gabriel as having some attitude right here. So Zechariah says, for I'm an old man and my wife is getting on in years. How will I know this is true? And the angel said, Gabriel says, I'm Gabriel.
I stand in the presence of the Lord.
Like, are you kidding me right now? Like, I'm a freaking angel, and I'm standing here telling you, like, look at my wings, dude. Like, like, what do you mean, how will I know? Like, come on.
This would be a sign. This right here, my presence here. When I first read Zechariah's question, how will I know? I was like, well, she'll have a baby or she won't. Like,
yeah.
Like, there's a way that you'll find out.
Give it a couple of months, man.
I know. Yeah. Patience, my friend. Patience.
Yeah. Anything you think is significant about him being struck mute in particular? Like, any number of things could have happened.
The resonance it has for me is, again, with Moses and his sort of tongue-tiedness and inability to speak that resolves over time.
Yeah.
And like Isaiah not wanting to speak and having something touched to his lips.
Oh, yeah.
To sort of purify his speech. So it sort of is like you've spoken something unpure, so your mouth is closed for a period of time.
That's so much more beautiful than where I was going, which is like, you know, like in my mind, sometimes men just need to shut up, right?
So, that's also very beautiful, Bobby.
And so here is Zechariah. Poetic. Like the angel's like, dude, I'm a freaking angel. I'm telling you.
Look at my wings.
Like, you do not need to ask this question. And so like, just like talk to the hand for the next 9.5 months.
Really?
It also is a plot device, as we'll see, about what's going to happen at the end of the story.
All right. Shall we carry on?
Let's do it.
All right. Verse 21. Meanwhile, the people were waiting for Zechariah and wondered at his delay in the sanctuary. When he did come out, he could not speak to them, and they realized that he had seen a vision in the sanctuary. He kept motioning to them and remained unable to speak. When his time of service was ended, he went to his home. After those days, his wife Elizabeth conceived, and for 5 months she remained in seclusion. She said, "This is what the Lord has done for me when he looked favorably on me and took away the disgrace I have endured among my people."
Like, so if you imagine what's happened, right? Like, the people are gathered there for the prayer, and there's this whole ceremony, and Zechariah goes into the temple, and he's supposed to come out, and he's supposed to pronounce the priestly blessing.
Mm-hmm.
And so he comes out, and it's not just that he can't talk, it's that he can't finish his ritual job, which is to now pronounce the blessing on the people. And so it's like he's gotten up, you know, he's gotten up in the pulpit or he's gotten up on the stage and everybody is waiting and then there's just nothing. And so there's this moment, like it's a really big kind of thing.
So then the narrative lectionary picks up again at verse 57. Now the time came for Elizabeth to give birth and she bore a son. Her neighbors and relatives heard that the Lord had shown his great mercy to her and they rejoiced with her. On the eighth day, they came to circumcise the child, and they were going to name him Zechariah after his father. But his mother said, "No, he is to be called John." They said to her, "None of your relatives has this name." Then they began motioning to his father to find out what name he wanted to give him. He asked for a writing tablet and wrote, "His name is John." And all of them were amazed. Immediately his mouth was opened and his tongue freed, and he began to speak, praising God. Fear came over all their neighbors, and all these things were talked about throughout the entire hill country of Judea. All who heard them pondered them and said, "What then will this child become? For indeed the hand of the Lord was with him." So here we have the narrative of John the Baptist's birth. What stands out to you other than the early use of the whiteboard?
Yeah, the writing tablet. Yeah, mm-hmm. It's like his little iPad. Yeah, I mean, so to me, so it's not entirely clear what's happening here. So Elizabeth says his name is John. Mm-hmm. And so this question about did Elizabeth and Zechariah communicate about what happened in the temple?
Right, is
unclear. Kind of an urgent question. Yeah. We just don't know. And so a couple of ways of, so the kind of more mundane way of interpreting it is that Zechariah got this instruction from Gabriel that his name should be John. He told Elizabeth, like, wrote it down on a piece of paper. Then she faithfully carried out the...
That's boring. I don't like that interpretation.
That's super boring. I don't like it either. So the other way of doing it is to say that Zechariah had not communicated it. And then Elizabeth knew that that should be his name for one reason or another. And so she sort of independently of Zechariah... Mm-hmm. Pronounces his name, and then Zechariah confirms that that's what his name actually should be. So they come to the name two separate ways. And therein lies the miracle, or the amazement of all the people, is that they both came up with the same name. Mm-hmm. I love that interpretation. If you read it that way, and I'm taking it that's the way you would prefer to read it.
That I would prefer that, yes.
Where do you think in that interpretation, where does Elizabeth get the name from? Like, why does she come up with that?
Why does she come up with it, and why isn't that part of the story? You know, that sort of would be my question. Like, if she, during this time of seclusion or whatever, had some strong sense that this was to be his name, whether it was sort of clearly through a vision or not, I don't know why that wouldn't be. That would make a really good addition to the story, Luke.
Yeah.
I've already edited Gabriel's grammar. Now I'll...
Yeah.
So I don't know, but, you know, sometimes you just know things. Like, you just know. Like, when my older child was born, we had a name for him, and we gave him the name, and then, like, 3 days later, I was like, I don't think that's right. Like, you just know. Like, you just know.
Yeah. I mean, the last thing that Elizabeth said in this text was back in verse 25, where she said, the Lord has looked favorably upon me. And then the name she gives her child is Yochanan. The Lord has shown favor. And so... one way of reading it is that she's just saying this should be his name because, in fact, the Lord has shown me favor, and that's why this child is here. And so she's honoring God with that name. And then Gabriel has said to Zechariah, name him because God is going to show favor to the people. And so these two kind of different ways in which God has shown favor are then brought together in the name. And then John the Baptist, John the infant, becomes... the sign and seal in a way to speak of the fact that God is really bringing favor to the people, like he said to Gabriel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I like that connection a lot. That makes a lot of sense to me.
What can you say? Anything you want to say about eighth day circumcision ritual? I know I was at the circumcision of your firstborn child, and I almost passed out. That's what I remember about that.
I think I almost passed out.
I had to sit in a chair in the corner.
I think that's also what I was doing. You know, circumcision happens on the eighth day. The baby is not named. The baby is nameless until that point. Again, we learn about circumcision first with Abraham, and Isaac is, I think, the first baby to be circumcised on the eighth day.
Yeah, I think that's right. And another instance in which they're following the law,
right.
Following the Torah to the T, like showing their righteousness.
Right.
Yeah, so the people they won't take Elizabeth's name, right? They have to go check it with Zechariah. Any thoughts about that little dynamic with the people?
It's sexist.
Yeah.
I mean, for this time period, or even for some modern periods in very sort of traditional communities, it's not surprising to me.
In a way, what has happened is, Gabriel has given Zechariah the opportunity to name his child, which is the father's prerogative in that culture, I assume. And he's lost it by questioning God, and so now Elizabeth is given the power of the name, which is quite a power. And so Zechariah has to confirm it, but
because that's the cultural norm.
Yeah, but really Elizabeth has already properly named him, and so the confirmation really is for the people. It's not, you know, like
I like that. I like that a lot.
And then everybody's kind of freaked out. I've never been quite entirely sure. But if we interpret it as they independently came to this name in one way or another, and they both named him the same thing, then the people are like, oh my gosh, this kid's going to be great. Because if it's just like Zechariah wrote down on a piece of paper and Elizabeth like read the piece of paper, and then...
Or that Elizabeth said it first, and then Zechariah was like, do what she said.
Yeah, what she said. Yeah.
Which, of course, we know that's not what happened, because we know he had this whole experience with Gabriel, but the people watching don't know that.
Yeah. And maybe when Zechariah's tongue is freed in verse 64, that's what he starts talking about. It's like, hey, let me tell you what happened back there in the temple.
Maybe.
I've been holding this in for 8 days. Or no, 9 months and 8 days.
For 8 days? Yeah.
9 months and 8 days. Yeah.
But again, this ends with a very sort of future-oriented, what will this child become?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, not just, it's very future-oriented. Okay, what's going on? Ready?
Yeah.
Verse 67. Then his father Zechariah was filled with the Holy Spirit and spoke this prophecy. Blessed be the Lord God of Israel, for he has looked favorably on his people and redeemed them. He has raised up a mighty Savior for us in the house of his servant David, as he spoke through the mouth of his holy prophets from of old, that we would be saved from our enemies and from the hand of all who hate us. Thus he has shown the mercy promised to our ancestors and has remembered his holy covenant, the oath that he swore to our ancestor Abraham, to grant us that we, being rescued from the hands of our enemies, might serve him without fear, in holiness and righteousness before him all our days. And you, child, will be called the prophet of the Most High, for you will go before the Lord to prepare his ways, to give knowledge of salvation to his people by the forgiveness of their sins. By the tender mercy of our God, the dawn from on high will break upon us, to give light to those who sit in darkness and in the shadow of death, to guide our feet into the way of peace. The child grew and became strong in spirit, and he was in the wilderness until the day he appeared publicly to Israel. You know, I know there's a lot to talk about in there, but just that last verse has me again thinking about Hannah and Samuel and the idea that Samuel was brought to, you know, once he was weaned, was brought to the temple to sort of grow in spirit there. But in some way, it is also sort of like semi-seclusion spiritual upbringing. And it's interesting to think about the type of preparation that John is bringing.
Yeah.
And why that, you know, that it happens in the wilderness instead of at the temple.
Yeah, that is really interesting. Yeah, because up until now, you've been sort of identifying how these stories are parallel. And then suddenly, in this important way, they diverge right there at the end. You know, my first thought about it would be that this is a critique of the temple cult. And, you know, one of the things we're going to have to kind of talk about as we go in the New Testament is, like, how do we interpret that in contemporary life? The way that I get to it is it's not a critique of Judaism, because John is fully inhabiting his Jewishness here, and his parents are priests and priestly family and all of those things. It's a critique of establishment religion, which is to say it's a critique of the religion that sits at the center of society in ways that are in collusion with the empire, in ways that are like official and having lots of money and having lots of status
power
in society.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think there's something here to say that the message of John, the message of Elijah, the message of Jesus isn't fostered in those environments. It's fostered in wildernesses that are away from these
real or metaphorical trappings. Wildernesses.
Yeah. Be they the Jewish temple or be they, you know, Christian megachurches or whatever it is, the gospel takes root in outside of those kind of places.
Yeah, no, I like that a lot. So this brings us to our usual ending question about what we do with the messages of this text and how we think about them for our time and our communities.
part of the connection that I'm making is just what I just said a minute ago in that last verse about the gospel being nurtured in wildernesses. But that's basically built on verse 80.
That's okay. It's in there.
Yeah, it's in there. It's in there. Squeaked it in. And there's something going on in here for me about the doubting, and particularly in this case, the masculine doubting of the promises of God. And Zechariah's having this kind of amazing opportunity and kind of blowing it by asking for a sign. And for Elizabeth, by contrast, without the benefit of an angelophany, she's the one who understands what is happening and says, oh, the Lord has been gracious to me, and recognizes what this means. I think she probably sees herself in a line of these other women. I mean, she knows the story of Sarah. She knows the story of Hannah. I think she probably understands that something significant has happened to her, and therefore that her child is going to be significant. And I mean, I don't quite know what to do with Zechariah having questioned an angel. That, you know, that's a really, like, I mean, to ask an angel, like, how do I know this is true? There is also something in that text about the gospel, the message taking root outside of the standards of authority. So it appears in the temple, in the sanctuary, to a priest who doesn't buy it. And then this woman who's not a priest, who's not in the temple, she gets it. And so that may parallel with that wilderness thing there too, that the message takes root in places that are not invested in the halls of power in traditional ways. And so then that would mean that the church needs to be paying attention to the ways in which God's message shows up in places that are not traditionally places of power or influence.
Yeah, no, I like that a lot.
What are you seeing in this text, Amy?
Reading this text got me thinking about the year zero. And I remember, I don't know if it was one of my kids or one of my students or someone asked me at some point, why is the year zero the year zero? Like, why did we restart the clock at zero? My answer is that because something in the world or something in your viewpoint has changed so significantly that you will always think of it as the before and the after.
Yeah.
Right? And so you start over. And I know there have been some points in my life that have felt like a zero, sort of like I know for me, I'm sort of dating myself here, but like September 11th.
Yeah.
That was a zero. Like, that was for a long time. I just remembered, like, the air felt different and the sky looked different and, like, everything in my being felt different.
Yeah.
And then there are more practical things like having a child. Like, you can always think back to what year was that? Like, well, was it before I had a child or after I had a child?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Right? Was it before 9/11 or after 9/11?
Yep.
And so being very aware of the imminent zero that's coming with the birth of Jesus, it has me thinking about sort of how then we look back to everything that sort of led up to it. Like, we know this really significant thing is here, and how do we think about what the world was like before that and the different things that sort of led us along the way to this really just fundamental show-stopping change.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, it would make sense that we see a lot of themes of sort of preparation and looking to the future and ties to the past. Like, those are important also. But yeah, this is all leading to the fundamental turning point. So it's interesting to see how that comes out in literature.
That's a really interesting way of thinking about that. I like that a lot.
Yeah, it's interesting stuff.
So next time we're going to do a special episode, a Christmas Eve text. We're going to be looking at, in the narrative lectionary, Luke chapter 2, verses 1 through 20. So I'm looking forward to that. Aren't you?
I am looking forward to that, yes.
It's going to be great.
All right. It's always good to speak with you.
Yeah, good to talk with you, Amy, and I will see you next time.
Thank you for joining us for NLDR, the Narrative Lectionary Podcast for people on the go. We'll be back again soon to pick up right where we left off in Luke chapter 2. Until then, have a great week. Thanks for being with us.